Kansas City Symphony Music Director Michael Stern makes his BSO and Tanglewood debuts tomorrow night in a concert featuring a popular violinist Joshua Bell, a Tanglewood guest every year since 1989, and bassist composer Edgar Meyer, who was with us earlier this hour.
As discussed earlier, the program will include the world premiere of Edgar Meyer's double concerto for violin, double bass, and the orchestra. And the program also includes Barber's Overture to the School for Scandal and two works by Tchaikovsky, Meditation for Violin and Orchestra, and the Symphony No. 4, a work performed as part of a second ever Tanglewood concert on August 7th, 1937.
Michael Stern is in his seventh season as music director of Kansas, and perfect for his life in music. He is a 1981 graduate of Harvard University, where he earned a degree in American history. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
How is that history degree working out in your conducting?
It helps me all the time, right? I put everything in context, and then I know how to massage deadlines when papers are due and I'm not ready to hand them in.
When did you start thinking about your career? I mean, you have this legendary father, Isaac Stern, so music is always a part of your life, I assume.
It was. I was a player from a very, very early age.
And so when did you start to think about it professionally? This isn't just the way
during college, because, I mean, my parents were very old world in the way they treated my brother and my sister and myself in terms of what they imagined our education should be, just not formal education, just as you're growing up. And like every good European family, music had to be a part of that. And so we had music around all the time. And as you mentioned, my father was in the business, and so we had music at a very high level around all the time. But we were never pushed towards looking for a professional path as musicians. And it came both to my brother and to me. His choice also during his college years was to choose music, and for me it was sort of at the end of my college experience, but I'd been playing since I was a kid, so it was a very natural evolution. I think I tried to move away from consciously thinking about music as a profession. I think music kept coming back to reclaim me. So
where did you play as a kid?
Well, I grew up in New York City, so you know, I had the usual round of lessons and Juilliard pre-college and, you know, summer things and so forth. And then when I went to Harvard, I sort of consciously decided I was going to major in something else, maybe become a lawyer. Can you imagine? But I played throughout my college. I played throughout my college career. And in fact, you know, I think it helps to have different perspective and not be myopic about the way you approach any artistic or intellectual endeavor. And so the more breadth you can bring to the experience, the better.
So once that decision is made, your next step was to then do what? I mean, you didn't look at it and say, oh, well, I just wasted the last 4 years at Harvard with a...
Well, I didn't consider I wasted anything, but I did find, I ran across this book called The Grammar of Conducting by Max Rudolph, which made a huge impression on me, and I sought him out, and he was living in Philadelphia at the time, and I went to see him, and I was lucky enough to have him agree to give me lessons. But at that time, he had been the head of the conducting program at Curtis during the Rudolph Serkin era, which had ended in 1973, and when Rudolph Serkin left the Curtis Institute of Music, which is one of the great conservatories to this day in the country, Max left the school, and with him left the conducting department. And so now it was 10 years later, and this was 1981, and there was no conducting program. But I applied to Curtis and was accepted as a player, and that gave me another reason to be in Philadelphia. So I was playing and studying with him privately, but everybody knew that I was sort of interested in conducting, and John Delancey, who was then the director of the school, made that leap and was successful in bringing Max Rudolph back to the school to start up again the conducting program, and I was in that first class. So I was at Curtis for 5 years, two exclusively as a player, one as an overlap, and then my last 2 years was exclusively as a conductor.
What makes a good conductor? What ingredients do you think you have to have to make that click and work with such a large body?
Well, first of all, you have to know your business in terms of being able to communicate clearly with the orchestra, and people think, well, that should be a repertoire of gestures which is efficient, and that is, of course, the best way to do it. And having good stick technique is one of the important underlining emphases that Max gave all his students, and so I was grateful to be able to get that. I think that's actually the easiest part of conducting. He always used to say, if you take a reasonably intelligent monkey and give him a week, you could probably get him to conduct Beethoven's Fifth in front of an orchestra like the Boston Symphony. The trick is being able to bring the next dimension to any group that you're playing with, whether it's the Boston Symphony or a student group. And if you're talking about a student group, especially a student group that you might have, for instance, here at Tanglewood, where the level is so incredibly high and the students are so already so experienced, so motivated, you want to be able to bring the insight and the inspiration and the execution up to a couple of levels higher than what would either be expected, anticipated, or possible if you were not there. You know, Max always used to say, if you don't believe that just simply by being there something different can happen, then you probably shouldn't be there. So there's a lot of psychology, and there's a huge amount of study. I think what the best kind of conductor for me is one who is so prepared that anything is possible, and yet there's this sort of transparent communication that can happen.
Could you give us just a little bit more of an example of a specific situation in which that communication occurs?
Well, communication in music is all on the breath. And I think some conductors know this instinctively and some don't. But I think that if you look at, especially in a place like Tanglewood, where time is at a premium in rehearsal, but the possibility is there because you're talking about the Boston Symphony. Mm. If everybody's on the breath, they do what they do at such a supremely high level that it's possible, even with short rehearsal time, to do absolutely anything. But that requires an efficient use of time, and everybody has to be on the same page at the same time quickly.
Michael, that's all breathing.
When you say something specific, that communication, if you look at a great bunch of musicians and you are in that breath and you're guiding that breath, there's a lot of periphery that doesn't need to go on.
Because I just don't get the word breath.
Breath. You take a breath in and you take a breath out, and that's music. That's exactly what I mean.
It's all in the breath.
It's all
you're
in the breath.
You're the conductor. You're breathing.
You have to breathe with all the music all the time. And I think that it's not about beats and laying down how fast the music goes or giving indications of how loud it goes. First and foremost, everybody has to know where they are in the phrase, because that's where music lives. And if you think about what does every child in the world do when they sing? What does anybody do when they play a wind instrument? When you come out and you're coming out of your mother's womb and you take your first breath, and there's pulse from your heartbeat, and there's that first cry, and that's music. And everything else comes from that. I mean, it's an incredibly simplistic but an incredibly true way of looking at how you get people to play together. Because if you say, play with me on the downbeat, and you give a gesture, everybody's going to interpret that downbeat in a certain way. Your job as a conductor is to make that gesture as explicitly clear and understandable as possible, and it facilitates. But really, it's the breath.
So it's not, and if I'm reading this right, then it's not a section. It's not the violins. It's not the woodwinds. It is all one body that is breathing together.
Well, but of course you have to give cues, because there are times in music where the strings stop playing and the woodwinds are playing, and
of
you
course.
Have to cue the woodwinds. But
as a whole,
in an ideal performance, everybody breathes from the beginning to the end of the piece. And when you're listening to your colleagues play and you're waiting to come in and you're not playing yet and you're feeling that phrase and the phrase is breathing, and then you have to come in and you breathe with it and then you go, that makes the seamless transition where music really happens.
Some conductors are yellers. They yell at people.
You don't seem like a yeller.
Okay. We know each other 2 minutes. You're already telling me. I'm not a yeller.
No.
No, I think you have to be on top of. I mean, there's a lot of tasks that have to be accomplished when you're standing on the podium, especially when you're watching the clock and you have a certain finite number of minutes to get a certain amount of work done. You have to take into account the experience of the people playing, their familiarity with the piece, the difficulty of the piece that requires absolute attention at the moment, as opposed to what can happen when we just, you know, settle into things a little bit. You have to organize rehearsing stuff on the program, which needs more attention, and trusting stuff. I mean, there's all kinds of decision-making that has to go on, but making music is about decision-making also. And when you're looking at a score, especially from a composer who is no longer around, you have to make decisions based on your best guess, really. What did Beethoven really mean in this piece? What did Tchaikovsky in the Fourth Symphony mean in this piece?
So in our final minute, you're going to be... Alan read what you'll be doing in the program, but of course...
Well, there was a mistake there, actually. It's not two works by Tchaikovsky. Josh Bell is playing the Ravel Tzigane. And in addition, we're doing the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony.
And then, of course, Edgar Meyer's piece.
And to do... I've worked with Edgar before. I've commissioned him. He is a incredible musician, fluent in so many different styles of music, and this is the world premiere of his double concerto that he wrote for Josh Bell and himself to play with the BSO to celebrate this Koussevitzky themed 75th year celebration, which is just fantastic. And the idea, I'm a great believer in doing as much American music and contemporary music as possible, and it's a joy to be able to do this piece with the BSO on this weekend.
Kansas City music director Michael Stern makes his BSO and Tanglewood debuts tomorrow night. For more information on this concert, the BSO and the Pomps, and of course Tanglewood, go to tanglewood.org, tanglewood.org. Maestro Michael Stern, a great pleasure to have you before our microphones. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful concert tomorrow night.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. You're listening to the Roundtables live broadcast from Tanglewood on WAMC.